Club History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 71, The Curious Case of Phineas Gage. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to discuss Phineas Gage's unusual injury in which a tamping iron was blown through his skull, which made him one of the greatest medical curiosities of all time. We'll discuss his time in Boston, his life post-injury, and the impact of his case on modern neuroscience. Consider yourself warned, though, the details of the accident are a little bit gory. But before we talk about blasting powder and brain matter, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
You may not think of a medical school as a place to look for a history museum, but the Warren Anatomical Museum at Harvard Medical School is the exception to that rule. The museum is named after Dr. John Collins Warren, a surgeon who performed the first surgery that used ether as anesthesia. He was the son of Harvard Medical School founder Dr. John Warren and the nephew of Dr. Joseph Warren, the patriot hero who dispatched Paul Revere to Lexington and died in the Battle of Bunker Hill. John Collins Warren graduated from Edinburgh Medical School, founded the New England Journal of Medicine, and became the first dean of Harvard Medical School. Starting in 1799, Warren began collecting what were called teaching preparations, preserved skulls and skeletons from people with interesting injuries or congenital abnormalities. His collection grew slowly to include all sorts of preserved body parts, basically anything that could be used to help instruct medical students on the human anatomy. When he retired from teaching in 1847, he gave this collection to the school, along with a large sum of money to maintain the collection. The collection continued to grow after the departure of Dr. Warren. Well-known physicians like Henry Jacob Bigelow and Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. continued to collect unique specimens and add them to the collection. Harvard professors made plaster casts of their patients and contributed those as well. The university hired artists to make paintings and models to illustrate important anatomical concepts, and after the advent of photography, photographs of important cases were added as well. In the 19th century, collections like this were ubiquitous. Any medical school would have to have teaching preparations in order to instruct their students. In the 20th century, medical education changed drastically, and medical museums became less important to the education of physicians. As the museum's website remarks, the survival of the collection was rare for an American medical school, as most U.S. medical museums were decommissioned in the mid-20th century. While most medical schools closed their museums and disposed of their collections, the Warren Anatomical Museum instead chose to shift its focus from medical instruction to a mission to preserve, classify, and make accessible the biological and artificial preparations and models critical for the education of 19th and 20th century physicians.
With this shift to focus on the history of medicine and medical education, the Warren Museum began buying up collections of surgical instruments, photographs, tissue samples, and other ephemera. In many cases, they bought up the collections that other medical museums were liquidating. The museum purchased the collection of the Boston Phrenological Society, consisting of hundreds of human skulls. It's a relic of the era in which phrenology, the practice of predicting a person's intelligence and character from the shape of their skull, was considered a legitimate medical science. It bought the collection of the Boston Society for Medical Improvement, which itself contained over 1,000 specimens used for medical education. It acquired a collection used in obstetrical education that had previously belonged to the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, as well as thousands of individual specimens and smaller collections. Their website says that the present collection includes approximately 3,200 anatomical and osteological preparations, 750 wet tissue preparations, over 1,000 watercolors, drawings, photographs, and lantern slides, an estimated 1,000 anatomical models and casts, 500 human and non-human calculi, and roughly 8,500 medical, dental, and public health instruments and devices. If you'd like to see this amazing collection, the John Collins Warren Anatomical Museum is open to the public Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. There's no admission fee, but you will be asked to show a photo ID and check in at a security desk. The museum is on the fifth floor of the Countway Library of Medicine at 10 Shattuck Street near the Harvard Medical Campus. There are parking garages available at the surrounding hospitals, but the easiest way to visit is probably by taking the Green Line E Branch, or 39 bus, to Brigham Circle, then walking about two blocks to the museum.
And for our upcoming event this week, we're featuring Speak Out, the fourth annual Boston Massacre Anniversary Orations at Old South Meeting House. The event listing tells us, each year from 1772 to 75, massive gatherings of men, women, and children were held at Old South Meeting House to commemorate the anniversary of the Boston Massacre, with rousing speeches by patriots John Hancock, Benjamin Church, and Dr. Joseph Warren. Join us to hear selected excerpts of these speeches performed by an intergenerational group in the Grand Hall where the orations took place 240 years ago. Learn about the orations and their significance with special guests, Bostonian Society Executive Director Nathaniel Shidley, historian Robert Allison, and Dr. Joseph Warren biographer Dr. Samuel Foreman. Audience members will also have the option to read from a selection of excerpts. Prizes will be awarded to the most rousing orators in youth and adult categories. Co-sponsored by the History Department of Suffolk University, the Bostonian Society, and the Department of History and Social Studies at Boston Public Schools, the event is part of the Occupation Series, marking the 250th anniversary of Boston's 1768 occupation by British troops. This free event will be held on Wednesday, March 21st at 6 p.m. We'll share the link to reserve tickets in this week's show notes. Now let's turn to our main topic, the curious case of Phineas Gage.
It's an understatement to say that you can see some interesting things on Boston Common.
I once saw a man running a kite through a fishing pole that looked to be flying about 15 stories up.
Well, I once saw two standard poodles with immaculate poodle cuts wearing oversized rainbow tie-dye bandanas to match their owner's oversized rainbow tie-dye shirt.
I was once asked by a police officer if I had seen a naked man, and I hadn't, but I did keep an eye out after that. But it's unlikely that we, or any of our listeners, ever saw something or someone as unusual as Phineas Gage. In November of 1849, it's possible that you would have come across Mr. Gage in a tent on the common where, for a small fee, you could see the hole in his head and the bar that passed through it. Accounts say that he was so loudmouthed, boisterous, and profane that the police ejected him from the common. You might also have encountered him in the streets around Harvard Medical School, where he was visiting in service to Dr. Henry Bigelow, in one of the earliest cases of a patient entering a hospital primarily to further medical research rather than for treatment. But let's start at the beginning.
This is another one of those instances in which Wikipedia is an incredible resource, with over 150 sources cited, so we're going to share their account of the accident directly. On September 13, 1848, Gage was directing a work gang blasting rock while preparing the roadbed for the Rutland and Burlington Railroad, south of the town of Cavendish, Vermont. Setting a blast entailed boring a hole deep into an outcrop of rock, adding blasting powder and a fuse, then using the tamping iron to pack, or tamp, sand, clay, or other inert material into the hole above the powder. As Gage was doing this at about 4:30 p.m., his attention was distracted by his men working behind him. Looking over his right shoulder, and inadvertently bringing his head into line with the blast hole, Gage opened his mouth to speak. In that same instant, the tamping iron sparked against the rock, and, possibly because the sand had been omitted, the powder exploded. Rocketed from the hole, the tamping iron, which was 1 1/4 inches in diameter, 3 feet 7 inches long, and weighing 13 1/4 pounds, entered the left side of Gage's face in an upward direction, just forward of the angle of the lower jaw. Continuing upward outside the upper jaw and possibly fracturing the cheekbone, it passed behind the left eye, through the left side of the brain, and out the top of the skull through the frontal bone. A later analyst described the tamping rod. The end which entered first was pointed, the taper being 11 inches long, ending in a 1/4 inch point. A physician who treated him at the time described these as circumstances to which the patient perhaps owes his life. The iron is unlike any other and was custom made by a neighboring blacksmith to please the fancy of the owner. The tamping iron landed point first some 80 feet away, smeared with blood and brain.
Despite having a 3.5-foot iron bar blasted through his head, some accounts say that Gage never lost consciousness. He landed on his back and had a few convulsions, but he was speaking and walking within minutes. He was alert through a 3/4-mile oxcart ride into town. Dr. Edward Williams describes what happened next. "When I drove up," he said, "Doctor, here is business enough for you. I first noticed the wound upon the head before I alighted from my carriage, the pulsations of the brain being very distinct. The top of the head appeared somewhat like an inverted funnel, as if some wedge-shaped body had passed from below upward. Mr. Gage, during the time I was examining this wound, was relating the manner in which he was injured to the bystanders. I did not believe Mr. Gage's statement at that time, but thought that he was deceived. Mr. Gage persisted in saying that the bar went through his head. Mr. Gage got up and vomited. The effort of vomiting pressed out about half a teacup of brain through the exit hole in the top of the skull, which fell upon the floor. A second physician, Dr. John Harlow, took charge of the case around 6 p.m. and later reflected, "You'll excuse me for remarking here that the picture presented was, to one unaccustomed to military surgery, truly terrific. But the patient bore his sufferings with the most heroic firmness. He recognized me at once and said he hoped he was not much hurt. He seemed to be perfectly conscious, but was getting exhausted from the hemorrhage. His person and the bed on which he was laid were literally one gore of blood." Treating this injury would be an overwhelming task in the operating room today at Mass General. But you have to remember that this is unfolding in a country doctor's office in 1848. So picture Dr. Michaela Quinn, not Dr. Meredith Grey. With Williams's assistance, Harlow shaved the scalp around the region of the tamping iron's exit, then removed coagulated blood, small bone fragments, and an ounce of protruding brain. After probing for foreign bodies and replacing two large detached pieces of bone, Harlow closed the rear wound with adhesive straps, leaving it partially open for drainage. The entrance wound in the cheek was bandaged only loosely. A wet compress was applied, then a nightcap, then further bandaging to secure these dressings. Harlow also dressed Gage's hands and forearms, which, along with his face, had been deeply burned, and ordered that Gage's head be kept elevated. Late that evening, Harlow noted, "Mind clear. Constant agitation of his legs being alternately retracted and extended like the shafts of a fulling mill. Says he does not care to see his friends, as he shall be back at work in a few days."
Alas, that would not be the case. Continuing with the Wikipedia, despite his own optimism, Gage's convalescence was long, difficult, and uneven. Though recognizing his mother and uncle, summoned from Lebanon, New Hampshire, 30 miles away, on the morning after the accident, on the second day, he lost control of his mind and became decidedly delirious. By the fourth day, he was again rational, knows his friends, and after a week's further improvement, Harlow entertained, for the first time, the thought that it was possible for Gage to recover. This improvement, however, was of short duration. Beginning 12 days after the accident, Gage was semi-comatose, seldom speaking unless spoken to, and then only answering in monosyllables. And on the 13th day, Harlow noted, "Failing strength, coma deepened. The globe of the left eye became more protuberant with fungus, deteriorated infected tissue, pushing out rapidly from the internal canthus, as well as from the wounded brain, and coming out at the top of the head. By the 14th day, the exhalations from the mouth and head are horribly fetid, comatose, but will answer in monosyllables if aroused. will not take nourishment unless strongly urged. The friends in attendance are in hourly expectancy of his death, and have his coffin and clothes in readiness. Galvanized, Harlow cut off the fungi which were sprouting from the top of the brain and filling the opening, and made free application of crystalline silver nitrate to them. With a scalpel, I laid open the frontalis muscle from the exit wound to the top of the nose, and immediately there were discharged 8 ounces of ill-conditioned pus, with blood, and excessively fetid. On the 24th day, Gage succeeded in raising himself up and took one step to his chair. 1 month later, he was walking up and down stairs and about the house into the piazza. And while Harlow was absent for a week, Gage was in the street every day except Sunday. His desire to return to his family in New Hampshire being uncontrollable by his friends, he went without an overcoat and with thin boots, got wet feet, and a chill. He soon developed a fever, but by mid-November, he was feeling better in every respect, walking around the house again. Harlow's prognosis at this point, Gage appears to be in a way of recovering, if he can be controlled.
By November 25th, 10 weeks after his injury, Gage was strong enough to return to his parents' home in Lebanon. Though quite feeble and thin, weak and childish on arriving, by late December he was riding out, improving both mentally and physically. And by February of 1849, he was able to do a little work about with the horses in the barn, feeding the cattle, etc. And as the time for plowing came, about May or June, he was able to do a half day's work after that and bore it well. In August, his mother told an inquiring physician that his memory seemed somewhat impaired, though slightly enough that a stranger would not notice. In April of 1849, Gage returned to Cavendish and visited Harlow, who noted at that time loss of vision of the left eye, a large scar on the forehead from Harlow's draining of the abscess, and upon the top of the head, a deep depression 2 inches by 1.5 inches wide, beneath which the pulsations of the brain can be perceived. Partial paralysis of the left side of the face. His physical health is good, and I am inclined to say that he has recovered. He has no pain in the head, but says it has a queer feeling which he is not able to describe. Though a year later some weakness remained, Harlow wrote that, physically, the recovery was quite complete during the 4 years immediately succeeding the injury. With a beyond miraculous recovery, the leading physicians of the day, and even today for that matter, were keen to learn from Gage's case. In November of 1849, Gage came to Harvard Medical School for several weeks for a presentation to the Boston Society for Medical Improvement, a group established in 1828 for the cultivation of confidence and good feeling between members of the profession, the eliciting and imparting of information upon the different branches of medical science, and the establishment of a museum and library of pathological anatomy.
Harlow later enumerated the factors that he believed contributed to Gage's survival. Number 1. The subject was the man for the case. His physique, will, and capacity of endurance could scarcely be excelled. He described Gage as a perfectly healthy, strong, and active young man, 25 years of age, nervo-bilious temperament, 5 feet 6 inches in height, average weight 150 pounds, possessing an iron will, as well as an iron frame. Muscular system unusually well developed, having had scarcely a day's illness from his childhood to the date of his injury. Nervo-bilious was a reference to phrenology, denoting an unusual combination of excitable and active mental powers, with energy and strength of mind and body making possible the endurance of great mental and physical labor. Number 2. The shape of the missile. Being pointed, round, and comparatively smooth, not leaving behind it prolonged concussion or compression. Despite its very large diameter and mass, compared to a weapon-fired projectile, the tamping iron's relatively low velocity drastically reduced the energy available to compressive and concussive shock waves. Number 3. The tamping iron did little injury until it reached the floor of the cranium, when, At the same time that it did irreparable damage, it created the opening in the base of the skull for drainage, without which recovery would have been impossible. As a medical student, Harlow observed an operation in which surgeon Joseph Pankost performed an operation for a head injury that initially appeared to result in recovery, but ultimately led to death. At autopsy, reaccumulated pus was found as tissue had blocked the opening in the dura, the outermost of the three layers of the matter that surround the brain and spinal cord. By keeping the exit wound open and elevating Gage's head to encourage drainage from the cranium into the sinuses through the hole made by the tamping iron, Harlow avoided Professor Pankost's mistake. And number 4. The portion of the brain traversed was, for several reasons, the best fitted of any part of the cerebral substance to sustain the injury. What Harlow's several reasons were is unclear, but he was likely referring, at least in part, to the understanding, slowly developing since ancient times, that injuries to the front of the brain are less dangerous than those to the rear, because the latter frequently interrupt vital functions such as breathing and circulation.
As to his own role in Gage's survival, Harlow merely reflected, "I can only say I dressed him. God healed him." But Malcolm McMillan, an honorary professor at the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences and the author of An Odd Kind of Fame, Stories of Phineas Gage, calls this self-assessment far too modest. Noting that Harlow had been a relatively inexperienced local physician, graduated 4.5 years earlier, McMillan's discussion of Harlow's skillful and imaginative adaptation of conservative and progressive elements from the available therapies to the particular needs posed by Gage's injuries emphasizes that he did not apply rigidly what he had learned. For example, foregoing an exhaustive search for bone fragments, which risked hemorrhage and further brain injury, and applying caustic to the fungi instead of excising it, which risked hemorrhage, or forcing it into the wound, which risked compressing the brain. While a physical recovery was made, the impact on Gage's personality was profound. Harlow described the pre-accident Gage as hardworking, responsible, and a great favorite with the men in his charge, his employers having regarded him as the most efficient and capable foreman in their employ. After the accident, Harlow notes, the equilibrium or balance, so to speak, between his intellectual faculties and animal propensities seems to have been destroyed. He is fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, which was not previously his custom, manifesting but little deference for his fellows, impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicts with his desires, at times pertinaciously obstinate, yet capricious and vacillating, devising many plans of future operations, which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned in turn for others appearing more feasible. A child in his intellectual capacity and manifestations, he has the animal passions of a strong man. Previous to his injury, although untrained in the schools, he possessed a well-balanced mind and was looked upon by those who knew him as a shrewd, smart businessman, very energetic and persistent in executing all his plans of operation. In this regard, his mind was radically changed, so decidedly that his friends and acquaintances said he was no longer Gage.
According to McMillan, Gage was the first case where you could fairly definitely say that injury to the brain produced some kind of change in personality. A recent NPR article details some of the ways that this case has been explored over the years. If you talk about hardcore neurology and the relationship between structural damage to the brain and particular changes in behavior, this is ground zero, says Alan Roper, a neurologist at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. It was an ideal case because it's one region of the brain, it's really obvious, and the changes in personality were stunning. So perhaps it's not surprising that every generation of brain scientists seems compelled to revisit Gage's case. For example, In the 1940s, a famous neurologist named Stanley Cobb diagrammed the skull in an effort to determine the exact path of the tamping iron. In the 1980s, scientists repeated the exercise using CT scans. In the 1990s, researchers applied 3D computer modeling to the problem. And in 2012, Jack Van Horn, an associate professor of neurology at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California, led a team that combined CT scans of Gage's skull with MRI scans of typical brains to show how the wiring of Gage's brain could have been affected. Neuroscientists like to always go back and say, "We're relating our work in the present day to these older famous cases which really define the field," Van Horn says. And it's not just researchers who keep coming back to Gage. Medical and psychology students still learn his story. And neurosurgeons and neurologists still sometimes reference Gage when assessing certain patients. Van Horn says, "Every 6 months or so you'll see something like that, where somebody has been shot in the head with an arrow, or falls off a ladder and lands on a piece of rebar. So you do have these kind of modern Phineas Gage-like cases."
There is some debate over whether these changes were exaggerated, but as we are not neurosurgeons, we didn't do a deep dive into the multitude of scientific sources that are available on the case. We do know that as a result of the change, Gage was unable to continue employment with the railroad. For a time, he traveled and exhibited himself as a living museum exhibit, as was reported during his time in Boston. However, it seems that some of these changes were temporary. He was able to secure employment for 18 months with a stable and coach service in New Hampshire. Then in August of 1852, Gage was invited to Chile to work as a long-distance stagecoach driver. Macmillan writes that this contrast between Gage's early versus later post-accident behavior reflects his gradual change from the commonly portrayed impulsive and uninhibited person into one who made a reasonable social recovery, citing persons with similar injuries for whom someone or something gave enough structure to their lives for them to relearn lost social and personal skills. Phineas's survival and rehabilitation demonstrated a theory of recovery which has influenced the treatment of frontal lobe damage today. In modern treatment, adding structure to tasks by, for example, mentally visualizing a written list is considered a key method in coping with frontal lobe damage. As a stagecoach driver, Gage would have had to rise early in the morning, prepare himself, and groom, feed, and harness the horses. He had to be at the departure point at a specified time, load the luggage, charge the fares, and get the passengers settled. And then he had to care for the passengers on the journey, unload their luggage at the destination, and look after the horses. The tasks formed a structure that required control of any impulsiveness he may have had. Macmillan continues, "En route, much foresight was required. Drivers had to plan for turns well in advance, and sometimes react quickly to maneuver around other coaches and wagons traveling at various speeds. Adaptation had also to be made to the physical condition of the route. Although some sections were well made, others were dangerously steep and very rough."
Yet after 7 years, his health declined, and he left Chile for San Francisco, arriving, in his mother's words, "in a feeble condition, having failed very much since he left New Hampshire. Had many ill turns while in Chile, especially during the last year, and suffered much from hardship and exposure." In February of 1860, Gage began to have epileptic seizures. On May 18th, Gage had a severe convulsion. The family physician was called in and bled him. The convulsions were repeated frequently during the next day and night, and he died on May 21st, 1860. In 1866, Harlow learned that Gage had died in California and made contact with his family there. At his request, the family had Gage's skull exhumed, then personally delivered it to Harlow in Woburn. Harlow remarked, "The mother and friends, waiving the claims of personal and private affection, with a magnanimity more than praiseworthy, at my request have cheerfully placed this skull in my hands for the benefit of science." After studying them for an 1868 retrospective paper on Gage, Harlow redeposited the iron, this time with the skull, in the Warren Museum, where you can see them on display today.
To learn more about Phineas Gage, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/071. We'll have photos of his skull, renderings of the damage, and a diagram of the injury. We'll include photos of the memorial plaque in Cavendish, Vermont, and a long-lost photograph of Gage after the injury, and an article on how it was discovered. And of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time to talk about Boston's first and only Rat Day.